Hello, this is episode number 31 of Tech Policy Weekly from the Technology Liberation Front for Thursday, September 27, 2007. I'm your host, Adam Thier of the Progress for Freedom Foundation. Last week, there was more big news coming out of Europe regarding Microsoft's ongoing antitrust saga with the European Commission. The European Court of First Instance made some important holdings regarding what Microsoft would be able to bundle within its Windows operating system, as well as some rulings about the disclosure of interoperability information for its systems. What are the implications of this decision for Microsoft as well as the rest of the industry and consumers? That's what we'll be discussing on today's show. Joining me for this week's show to discuss these issues are my fellow Technology Liberation Front contributors, Hans Haney of the Discovery Institute. Hi, Hans.
Hey, Adam.
Cord Bloomquist of the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Hi, Cord.
Hey, Adam.
And Tim Lee of the Cato Institute. Hi, Tim.
Hello.
And we are also pleased to be joined this week by a very special guest, Jonathan Zuck, who's the president of the Association of Competitive Technology. So, Hans, let me start with you. Why don't you give us just a little bit of background about what's been going on over there and the decision that that came down 10 days ago now, I guess, and why it's important?
Well, Adam, you know, we've been reading about Microsoft for years, and after a very, very lengthy litigation in the United States, the focus shifted over to Europe, where some of the companies who criticized Microsoft's business practices in the United States didn't get what they wanted in the U.S. courts, and so they went to the European Union. And in March of 2004, following a lengthy EU investigation, Microsoft was required, first of all, with respect to its Windows Media Player, to which it had bundled together at no additional cost to the customer in its PC operating system, but that had to be removed. Now, in the United States, all Microsoft was required to do was allow computer manufacturers and end users to remove the icon from their desktop for Windows Media Player. But Europe went further than that and required them to completely remove all of the Windows Media Player code. And Microsoft complained that this was going to be extremely difficult to do. It was going to change the entire product and things wouldn't work. But they went ahead and did it. They came back and reported that, you know what, hardly anyone's buying this. Yeah, that's another story. We'll get to that in a minute. The second major aspect of this decision, Adam, is the workgroup server interface specifications. And competitors argue that they need these interface specifications, which Microsoft historically has provided, and then in a kind of a change of policy started withholding some of this interface information. And the competitors argue that they need all of it because otherwise they can't build servers which will seamlessly interconnect with Microsoft's workgroup servers. This gets us into the whole essential facilities doctrine, which I'd love to talk about, you know, as part of this conversation. But those are the two key elements of the ruling. And Microsoft was not required to do that in the U.S.
Okay, Cord, you've also been following this issue closely. Tell us, you know, why is this a concern for not just Microsoft, but for industry as a whole and also for consumers from your perspective?
Well, I think it's an issue because it's viewing the entire market in the incorrect way. We should be looking at a wider media market. If we want to even call it a computer, a digital media market, that's fine. But media players are a small slice of that, and we've seen more competition enter in the interim period between the original ruling and now this appeal. iTunes is a big force in media players, and even though it doesn't have as much market share as Microsoft's media player, iTunes and the iPod have created the online music market. They've created the MP3 market. XM Sirius Radio has entered into the mix. There's now new hybrid Wi-Fi satellite MP3 playing devices out there. So it seems to me like if we're looking at benefit for the consumer, the market's providing competition for desktop-based music entertainment. So why are we forcing Microsoft to pay for a monopoly it really doesn't have, it probably never has, just so that the EU can use this court decision as precedent to attack iTunes for a monopoly that that it probably doesn't have and never will have, and its power is going to slip away in the coming years. So I think this is just a giant category mistake. It's a way of looking at the market way too narrowly. when if we look at the wider market, we see that it's healthy with competition.
And don't forget YouTube. I mean, probably the biggest media platform is Adobe's browser-based Flash platform, which is used by now dozens of different websites. It just absolutely is stomping the old, not just Windows Media, but QuickTime and Reel. So I agree, it seems awfully hard to argue that tying Windows to Windows Media Player is or ever was really a serious competitive threat to a serious threat of monopolizing the online media marketplace.
Jonathan, you were over there in Europe. Tell us a little bit about your opinions about what's happened over there, because you also testified in this case. Talk to us about what your concerns are about what the European Court of First Instance has held in this decision.
Well, it's interesting because I think there's actually two different aspects to the issue. One is the Commission's intentions, and then the Court of First Instance's actual decision and intentions. And it's probably important to separate the two of them because there was a decision, administrative decision, made by the Commission for certain remedies against Microsoft, a fairly large fine, as we've discussed, and certain requirements that amounted to a compulsory licensing of some information that had been requested by Sun and IBM and a few others relating to interoperability. And so then Microsoft took this to the Court of First Instance. So it was the first time it ever saw a courtroom. But what the CFI, the 13-judge panel of the CFI, really did was affirm the authority of the Commission more so than they did any real decision-making or new law associated with antitrust. As it turns out, it's been over 25 years since the CFI has overturned a Commission decision on Article 82, which is the European Union's version of what we have as the Sherman Act here. And so I think there's two things. One is that the Court of First Instance expressed a lot of deference, if you will, for the Commission and their analyses and their decision-making powers, more so than they did an actual analysis of the facts of the case itself. So in some ways, what they did was hold up a big mirror and reflect all this back to the Commission. And then what becomes interesting is what the Commission is going to do with this sort of free, you know, get-out-of-jail-free card that they've been handed by the CFI.
So what happens next then?
Well, there's a couple of different issues that were at stake. One that had to do with a market-leading company having the ability to integrate new technology into its market-leading product. And at one point, there was actually even an amicus brief filed by Airbus over their concerns on this issue because they're concerned about integrating new functionality into their airplanes. But a rather stern phone call from the Commission led them to withdraw that amicus brief. But it does sort of point to the fact that this isn't a Microsoft-only issue, but in fact has to do with sort of technology integration generally. So there's going to be this ongoing issue about how do companies that find themselves in a leadership position, not even really a monopoly position, but just a leadership position in the market, how are they able to expand the functionality of their applications and integrate new capabilities without getting into sort of competitive problems within European regulators?
Well, let me play devil's advocate and ask the question, you know, obviously one argument is that they're going to have a problem shipping a global product when you've got crazy antitrust laws and patchworks of policies in different regions, but don't we already have regional-based encoding systems and various types of products and specialized products for certain markets? I mean, if I'm a skeptic here, I just push back and say, so what? Now you've got a different set of rules in the European Union you got to live by. What's wrong with that?
Well, most of the variations around the world are linguistic. So it has more to do, and the products have been architected around those linguistic differences. So, you know, as a former programmer, I, you know, had some dealings with the sort of external strings, they're called, or resources, that you could use to localize your software so that, you know, the dialog box that says file save as would say something else in German, rather than using the English text. So the products over time, especially large ones like Windows, and have been architected around the sort of linguistic flexibility. There's a big difference there between that and the actual functionality of the operating system and the actual software that's available. And as far as our members are concerned, the APIs that are available. I mean, in the case, if you know, anytime you walk through an airport, you see those booths for the Rosetta Stone software, right? It's for learning languages, and it's now like in every airport. Well, that's an example of a piece of software that relies on specifically the media functionality built into Windows. Not the media player that you and I use to play music, but the actual underlying functionality of the operating system to play media streams. And so removal of that functionality has implications for a kind of fragmentation of sort of the target operating system for these products. Now, if I'm Rosetta Stone, I have to start creating multiple versions of the software to deal with multiple regulatory authorities around the world.
So the other piece of this is the disclosure of the API that Sun and some other companies wanted access to. Can you tell me a little bit more about how that process works and what kinds of disclosures are being required?
Yeah, and that's another sort of topic for discussion because one of the big debates that happened in Europe was sort of the difference between interoperability and cloning. In other words, do you need enough information to create an exact duplicate of a product or just enough information to talk to a product? And a lot of that got kind of obscured in the rhetoric surrounding the debate. But fundamentally, Sun, IBM, and Novell are interested in creating servers that are capable of being dropped in into a sort of Microsoft-dominated work group environment, right? So if you've got a business that's built up around Microsoft servers, how easy is it to just drop in a Novell or a Sun server and make it part of the network, a happy part of the network, and creating a heterogeneous environment? And to some extent, that's already happening in the marketplace today. In other words, any big enterprise you go into has servers for multiple vendors today for sharing internet connections, sharing hard drives, sharing printers, et cetera. And so the issue really comes down to a piece of technology called the Active Directory, which is a piece of software that it's a kind of server product, big database that stores information about the organization, who the employees are, where their desks are, what their phone numbers are, what their vacation schedule is, et cetera, and perhaps most importantly, what their rights are on the network, right? You're allowed to get to these servers but not these servers. You can log in from your home office or the office in London but not the one in Istanbul, et cetera. All that kind of rights information is stored within that as well. And every one of the other vendors, IBM, Sun, and Novell, have products in that space. And so then the question is it really worthwhile for them or anyone else to create a piece of software that pretends to be an Active Directory server so that it can participate in that close of an association? And that's been sort of the debate around the interoperability issue. But the court didn't really address it. And this is a perfect example where the court said, well, we just rely on the commission and its economists, et cetera, to evaluate the technology and the facts of the case, and they sort of punted it back to the commission, and they had a pretty expansive view of what's requested of Microsoft. And I think the problem for a lot of us is that embedded in some of that is some intellectual property. There's some patented technology and some trade secrets that are specific competitive advantages for Microsoft as its Active Directory gets reviewed against Novell's directory services. You know, on a product-by-product comparison, there's some features that Microsoft has that the others don't that are tied up in these protocols. And so that starts to become an active question, too, is what are the terms under which Microsoft should be compelled to license that information to its competitors?
It seems like a better approach to this would be to ensure that there's a relatively robust right of reverse engineering and then allow competitors, if they want this information, they're perfectly capable to do what, for example, Samba does, which is just to, tinker with these products, figure out how they work, and then if they're able to, build a compatible product, allow them to do that and to market it, but not force Microsoft to disclose the information. It seems like you would avoid a lot of the regulatory headaches that are going to come up when you have disputes over how much information needs to be disclosed and under what terms.
Well, Samba were actually a part of this dispute and testified at the hearing and described the process of reverse engineering to get as far as they did get. And I think fundamentally, you know, their testimony is that this is too hard, right? I mean, they'd rather have the information given to them. And so they have been reverse engineering and to great effect, but they say, well, we're perpetually a year behind or something like that because of the reverse engineering process.
Well, the entire domestic PC market is based on reverse engineering, right? And it seems like domestic PC makers did the legwork, and of course you're going to be behind. It seems like you're asking for a government handout there. It's not that Microsoft is hiding behind a patent or a copyright, but really they're just hiding behind the difficulty of untangling their work.
Oh, I mean, the notion of how difficult it is to take these internal protocols, which is something designed specifically for a piece of software, one instance of Windows Server to talk to another instance of Windows Server, right? It's a little bit like the communication language that twins have that nobody else understands, right? And try to roll that out in a way that's really consumable by their competitors is actually proven to be an awful lot of work.
Do we know what kind of cost that's going to impose on Microsoft?
Well, there is one funny issue related to the case, and that had to do with the a trustee that was put in place by the commission as a kind of technical consultant for Microsoft's compliance with the interoperability order. And that trustee organization has thus far cost, just the checks and balance organization has thus far cost Microsoft $18 million. So that has nothing to do with the actual production of these materials, but just the commission's mechanism for checking the materials. But that's the one thing they won on in the court. The court of first instance came back and said the commission didn't have any right to hire this trustee and make Microsoft pay for it. So they gave them the right to charge Microsoft the $800 million, but not the right to charge Microsoft the $18 million.
The Samba Users Association, I don't know what they said during the trial, but they did tell the media, and they're quoted in the media as indicating that, you know, in many fields we're 10 years behind Microsoft, and the lag is growing with every new step Microsoft takes. And it seems to me as an outside observer that the commission views the preservation of this industry as requiring them to basically hamstring Microsoft. I mean, the commission appears to be concerned that this industry is on the verge of annihilation. Through no fault of Microsoft's, by the way. But what we have here is a complete misapplication of the essential facilities doctrine that we follow here, which we've been through this because when the doctrine was created in 1912, it dealt with a very fact-specific situation where it was impossible as a practical matter for competing railroads to enter St. Louis because of topography and geography. And over the years, that doctrine has been stretched out. Now it applies to credit cards and soft drinks and all kinds of, I mean, pervasively throughout the economy. It's become such a problem. Commentators have criticized it for years because the fact is that it takes both investment and competition to lead to innovation. And so, you know, fortunately, in 2004, the Supreme Court refused to confirm or deny whether the essential facilities doctrine is even established law anymore. And so what we have in the EU is taking, basically going back to the approach that we used to follow here, just as we are tightening up after watching this doctrine, get abused for years. And so what we've really got the EU doing here is a regulatory taking, which is really a very serious problem. To me, it's almost like some kind of, you know, trade retaliation or expropriating the property of foreign investors. It's much more subtle and much less direct, but I mean it is punishment.
So what do you think Microsoft's strategy is likely to be going forward? Are there any more legal appeals, or are they is this pretty much the end of the line from a legal perspective?
Well, there's certainly a vehicle for appeal, which is the European Court of Justice. So the Court of First Instance can be appealed to, because they are, in fact, the first court. They're not actually an appeals court, and can be appealed to the European Court of Justice. what Microsoft will actually do, I think will have more to do with the ease with which they're able to settle the other issues that are before the commission currently. I think they have a lot of, there's some open issues, again, that IBM and Sun have brought up via related to Office and security and other issues like that. And so I think Microsoft's hoping to go back to the negotiating table, and if they're able to have an effective negotiation there, I think that they're going to be less inclined to appeal. I mean, fundamentally, like I said, I think the court decision's one thing, and what we really need to see is what the commission's going to do going forward, because one of the issues that came up on this interoperability information is how much Microsoft can charge for that information. And I think because one of the goals of the commission is the sort of facilitation, if you will, of the open source software alternatives, they have a huge incentive internally to push Microsoft toward a $0 point for the licensing of this technology. And I think that starts to cause, you know, real questions about intellectual property protection, and that can be a long discussion in and of itself. But having the commission set the prices for your IP, I think, is a dangerous precedent as well.
Well, that's going to do it for Tech Policy Weekly this week. I want to thank our guests, Jonathan Zuck, for joining us, as well as Hans Haney, Cord Bloomquist, and Tim Lee. And to read more commentary from the entire Technology Liberation Front gang, please visit us at techliberation.com. Also, if you'd like to comment on something you heard on today's show, you can do so on our website. Just go to techliberation.com/podcast, and you can leave a comment on the page for this specific episode. If you like what you heard, please tell a friend. Please write a review of the show on iTunes, and don't forget to dig our podcast. Until next week, I'm Adam Thier. See you then.